Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Hey everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond, and I want to welcome everybody to another episode. In the introduction, I always talk about how we have fantastic guests and people that come on and donate their time and their expertise and their wisdom. And today, you guys, we've got another one, and I know you're going to be blown away. Please don't worry about taking notes. As always, you can download the podcast and you can also share it, which we really appreciate. I want to talk about today's guest, though, give you a little bit of background on who this individual is. And as you guys know, that most of the folks that come on and our guests are people that are what I call wounded healers, people that have the hero's journey and the lived experience. And today's guest is no exception for that. This individual is a UMass certified MBSR teacher and is a retired neurologist and sleep specialist. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about specifically mindfulness and sleep and how we can integrate those things to help us with, you know, getting some sort of sleep that is restful, that has us awaken in the moment, as well as being present in the moment with mindfulness. Our guest today has attended the University of Miami undergraduate and medical school and received his MD degree in 1980. So what does that tell you right there? 1980, it means that this person is jam-packed with a bunch of wisdom. So listen up, grab your coffee, grab your water, whatever it is. Be present in the moment with today's PTSD and Beyond podcast. He's also trained at Emory University School of Medicine, Georgetown University School of Medicine, and University of Texas, Cancer Center, and is a board-certified neurologist back in 1987. The one thing I want you guys to understand about our guest today is that this person has been walking the journey of mindfulness since 1998, is going to share a snippet of their story, and served as the medical director of the Sleep Center at the Jupiter Medical Center in Florida. You guys, I want to give a heartfelt, warm welcome to Dr. Gus Castellanos. Gus, welcome to PTSD and Beyond's podcast.
Thank you, Deb. That was a great introduction. I didn't know I deserve it, but I'll take it. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. No, thank you for being here with us today. It's interesting, folks, how Gus and I came about. It's you make connections on social media and you see what people are posting, and there are things that resonate and say, you know what, this is something that I keep hearing from our listeners of struggling with. First of all, what is mindfulness? Okay. And I hear so much about it. I don't really understand a lot about it, and I want to get some different perspectives. So while I also practice mindfulness, when we can provide wisdom from many, you know, folks that walk the journey, the healer's journey and that hero's journey, we can provide many different lenses and insights on what mindfulness is. And it's really cool because, Gus, there's always some sort of snippet that resonates with somebody. And what happens is people will say things like, you know, I've heard this over and over again, but it was the way that this person said it that I had that Descartes aha moment, right? And then the sleep component. So, I mean, you are like the expert guy to have on, I should say person to have on today. So share with our listeners a little bit about how did you get to mindfulness in 98 and about the you know, experiences in working with, you know, sleep and the sleep center.
Yeah, sure. So I started in neurology back in 1981, and it was in that time period that I exposed to sleep, excuse me, and became a neurologist and then also subspecialized in sleep medicine. And that was mostly late 80s and through the 90s. And it was in the 90s when I was starting to burn out as a doctor. Now, there wasn't the burnout for physicians is a big topic these days. And it's even worse now with the pandemic, as you can imagine. Right. It wasn't talked about that way back in the 90s. So I was doing some things that I shouldn't have been doing. One was it had a tendency to workaholism. So the worst thing that things got to work, I would work harder, thinking I could clear it up with my own expertise. And then the other thing is I was using the pharmaceutical samples that I would get in the office. which by the way includes sleep aids because I was a sleep specialist. When I was overusing them and, you know, misusing them, I shouldn't have been doing what I was doing. But, you know, it was getting to be a problem and I was burning out, stressing out at work. And so in 1998, a friend of mine at Jupiter Medical Center, where I was the medical director of the sleep center, calls me up and says, hey, we're bringing mindfulness-based stress reduction to the hospital. And it's good for insomnia and it's good for pain and it's good for caregiver burnout. So send patients. And actually what happened was I said very quickly, I said, no, Mark, no, thank you. I'm a good doctor, not a woo-woo doctor. I don't believe in that kind of stuff. And then he said, no, the University of Massachusetts Medical School, lots of research, et cetera. Look it up. And so I did. And when I looked at the research, I said, yeah, I need help with some of my patients. I called him back up and he said, yeah, send the patients this day and we're going to be meeting here. And then he said to me, Gus, you should take the class because you're pretty messed up. So why don't you join me and we'll take the class together. And so I did. And I found it to be very beneficial. And it was very interesting to do that. I say that story because it was something I have been practicing in medicine where I get to experience what I was sending my patients to. Mm-hmm. I can see the benefits. And there's some stories along those lines that I would have thought the patients were crazy when they said things, except because I took mindfulness, I got it. I understood what they were saying. But to be followed very quickly, I did do well as long as I was practicing mindfulness. Once I fell off the practice bandwagon, which happens to so many of the people I deal with these days, mm-hmm. things got worse again. So I took the class again, and then things really got better. So,
you know, that's really interesting to talk about. Of that, we get to experience right what our patients. Some of us use the word clients. I'm non-licensed, so I use the word client when I'm working with folks, and that is so true. Where our awareness as practitioners, our lenses, and even our biases change when we see what our patients and our clients are experiencing, and then we do too. We do too. One of the words I'd like you to define, if you could, at least share what you mean by it, is the word practice. In mindfulness, as well as with helping folks develop skills and learning different techniques to, over time, use and practice to develop a skill, the word practice seems to be interchanged with so many other different words, actually meanings. So could you share with us, our listeners, when you say practice for mindfulness and getting off the, you know, mindfulness practice bandwagon, how many times does that happen then, right? We always just restart where we're at. What does that word mean?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I've never been asked directly. I know I practice medicine. I practice mindfulness. I can practice poor sleep habits. Yeah, I can do anything. So for us, I think for practicing, when I came into the mindfulness world, it was more about devotion to what the mindfulness is about, as opposed to a specific outcome, that so-called practice makes perfect thing. Particularly in mindfulness, striving to get somewhere, trying to get the best sleep I can get, et cetera, may get in the way of actually getting the better sleep. So it's a consistent attempt at developing the tools, the skills, and techniques of mindfulness. So if we talk about mindfulness practice, you can practice mindfulness, if you will, in just everyday activity.
Right.
You can practice it formally, listening to a recording or not a recording, sit down for 40 minutes and do the mindfulness meditation, if you will. You can just do it while eating or walking.
Right.
So
that's really interesting too, Gus, because what I have found sometimes, not always, when folks are actually connecting with, say, whether it's the PTSD and Beyond chat or the PTSD and Beyond podcast, and they're sending a message, one of the questions that they want to know too is, what is mindfulness? I think there's more confusion, at least that's what my experience is right now, of the confusion of folks that are wanting to understand more about what mindfulness is. And there's so many different ways that you can do it. I think one of the cool things about mindfulness is, as far as the word practice and mindfulness, it's not about doing. It's about awareness and being. So you and I can be practicing, if I will want to put that word in quotes, mindfulness right now. Maybe there was something that happened in the morning and I needed to redirect my mindset, my thoughts, my emotions, and pay attention to what my physical body is doing and be here present right now together. And perhaps maybe a benefit, right? The growth part of and the value part of COVID is it has given people the opportunity to slow down, to pay attention, and to be aware of things that are important, changes that they'd like to make, things that they'd like to cultivate and develop. and maybe things that they'd like to try, whether it's food or an exercise or a relationship or a job. So circling back, because I get off track too, what do you think, you know, what would be helpful for listeners to understand and know about mindfulness?
Yeah, and to make a quick comment about what you're saying, developing, learning new skills and all that, just to kind of be careful, because you went from go be, don't do so much, and now you're saying, hey, you got opportunity to do some stuff, which is not it's to us, at least for me as a mindfulness teacher, it isn't whether you're doing a lot or not doing a lot, it's how, the quality of your attention and your awareness. And so there's where I get to the definition of how, what mindfulness can be described, because there is no one definition, as you know. It's, for me, it's something simply along the lines of being in the present moment, aware of what you're doing, what's going on in the present moment as it's happening, and then cultivating a friendly attitude or a kind attitude, non-judgmental attitude. So in the present moment, aware of what's happening, being non-judgmental. And that's all it is. And you're right, we can be doing it now, because I am monitoring my heart and my sweaty palms, you know, as I'm getting a little nervous. I'm just watching, noticing, I'm practicing. This is what I'm trying to do, noticing my body as it's happening. And then going from there.
So what do you think about the exchange between people? So for example, what I mean about the exchange between people with mindfulness is that if I'm aware that maybe someone else is experiencing nervousness or anxiety, then as a person who, you know, is learning to be more mindful and learning how to integrate more techniques to be skilled reflexively, I say, so it just happens naturally. It's not that I created a habit. It becomes part of who I am, and it's the same response as if I'm blinking, drinking, swallowing, you know, those kinds of things. I get up in the morning, I brush my teeth, or even just sitting here now, I'm breathing and I'm not even paying attention that I'm breathing. So when we're together, and as a person who, you know, practices mindfulness from a love, I love this part too, the heart-based loving, kindness, non-judgment, as I'm aware of, say, something that's happening to somebody else, how can I exchange then my mindfulness knowledge and not even really knowledge, but more of a kindness, and extend that to someone else? Because right now, so many people are hurting. How can we share that with folks?
So are you referring to like us two in a one-to-one conversation, or to just people in general that may be listening to this?
It people who are listening, for example, because when you were talking about, I'm paying attention, I'm mindful of how my heartbeat, you know, my heart rate and my body and everything. The thought that came to my mind is people that are listening right now are wondering, especially people that need assistance. We're always looking for example, somebody who is, you know, our go-to person. So if somebody is, say, starting to take some of the tips that we're going to talk about today and use them and then share that with somebody else, and then to say, hey, when I'm experiencing, say, my anxiety or my hypervigilance or some of these post-traumatic stress symptoms, how can the awareness of mindfulness then help each other? Like, for example, if I was with somebody, I could be aware of that and then ask some questions. But from your perspective, how can we help each other?
Yeah, so it starts with the awareness of where you're at. So if you're not in tune to what's happening in your own body, it's going to be, if you're a little bit dysregulated, your view, your perception of what's happening on the other person may be faulty. Let's put it that way. So always checking in with your side. And then there is that tendency of our so-called autonomic nervous systems, automatic nerves that are happening throughout our body, to co-regulate. So we can actually, through the, we call the characteristic of empathy, feel what's happening on the other person, whether you know it from energetics or some kind of facial body movements, whatever it may be. You have a sense of what's happening on the other side. If they're hyper aroused, if they're very active and that fight or flightish kind of thing, sensing that, and the what we teach is, better than trying to get certain words out, it's best to try and calm each other. So mm-hmm. If I feel they're dysregulated, the first attempt should be to calm the other person. If I'm dysregulated, the first attempt should be calm myself, rather than to spit out some words that are going to be so useful and this and that, make me look bright and all that. So,
no, I agree with that completely. We talk a lot about this with folks that are in the chat and then the podcast too, email responses back and forth is, you know, we all know when we're on the airplane, I mean, everybody's going to probably nodding right now. I know where she's going with this. When you're on the airplane, it's always, you know, assist yourself with the oxygen mask before placing it on someone else. And oftentimes we are in the mode, if you will, of helping others to the point where we need at some point to step back and say self-care and then, give to others and share with others. So that's really good information for people to be aware of. Where am I at? How am I doing? And the projection, there's something else that comes up too with folks with post-traumatic stress, whether they've been clinically diagnosed or self, diagnosed, I took a test, or just people that are saying, hey, I'm experiencing some of these symptoms, is the projection. So projection of anger, projection of emotions, projection of, where their mindset is at. And how can mindfulness then help us to be in the present moment of taking that pause before the, reframing the reaction into a response, for example?
Yeah, again, getting a little bit on the purist side from all the work I've done. So the mindfulness is about the awareness of what's actually happening. And that will involve a pause until you get so, so good at it that you're sort of in that awareness state all the time, which I haven't got there, by the way. But so most of the time when something's happening, it does involve that little space that we have, we pause. Choosing a response, though, is going to probably depend on the person, the situation they're in. And you're right about perception. The perception initially may be something like this because we're all dysregulated and triggered. But as we calm by just pausing, our perception may actually change. And so what you would have done initially would change us to do something else. And what I always say is, regardless of what you decide to do when you act, if you're doing it with mindful awareness, the results will always be better than if you're doing it without mindful awareness. Even if it's something that seems to be unhealthy, if you're saying, I'm going to do this, I know it's not good for me or good for them, but I'm aware completely, consequences still happen. It'll be better than if you did it just mindlessly and just threw something out there and then you puzzled, how did I get here? What happened? So it's about that. If you keep your attention on your side, there'd be that a little bit of a pause, a little bit of a space for you to then choose. Your inner wisdom, we really trust in our classes. We trust that your inner guidance, your inner wisdom, your experience will guide you on what the best thing to do in that moment is.
I also believe that, and I practice that too. There are times where decision-making, we talk a lot about decision-making, and this applies for myself too, is I can tell you that if I need to make a decision and I know that I'm not in a good space, I will pause and I just won't do it. And it's not that I'm being stubborn. It's I'm aware that if I do something right now, it's not going to be the outcome that I want. So I need to just take a moment and create some space for myself. And it doesn't take a long time. Sometimes it takes a little longer, but I've gotten myself.
But that in itself, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that in itself don't give it. That is a decision. The decision not to make the decision is the choice that you make in that space.
Correct.
And then you let whatever happen. Like you say, sometimes it bubbles up, sometimes it doesn't, but that's the important one right there, the first one. So
right, exactly. And why I'm smiling saying this is because when I share with someone, like for example, I'll say, you know what, I just need a moment. I need to create some space for myself and take a moment. Sometimes I just say, you know what, I need a moment right now. And people that know me know exactly what I'm going to do. They know exactly what I mean. My kids know what I mean. My best friend knows what I mean. People that I work with know what I mean when I say that. And sometimes it means I'm just going to walk and go grab myself a cup of hot water. And in that walking, and I love hot water, by the way, it's one of the things that I practice with. And you can feel yourself. There's a physical change that happens. You can feel it. You can sense it. The energy shifts. I want to say it can actually change the environment energetically with where you're at around your house or whoever you're with. And then if you're super aware, then you can see how it affects other people and how that also changes. Children especially are really open to mindfulness practice. Both my kids It's wonderful how I've seen them grow and develop. But I want to also touch a little bit, if we can, transition here to mindfulness and sleep, because right now so many people are, I don't even know what to call it, sleep deprived, having a difficult time. We have people who have had challenges for years with having one day of restful sleep to now it's, I can't remember the last time when I had a good night's sleep.
Let me start, which we discussed before the podcast. I'm a little bit, radical on some of the things I do. I do have, everything I do is really evidence-based. So I'm coming from a point of view of a lot of research, but more than an evidence-based practice for me, mindfulness is an experience-based practice. So from years of working with people and my own, whenever I have sleep problems, it's not so much about getting better sleep. It's about feeling better in your life. So when you reframe it a little bit, rather than saying, I'm going to do mindfulness and I expect this, my sleep to look like this, even if I'm feeling okay, it's not so bad. We want to make sure we don't disconnect, because this is what happened to me early on after I went through mindfulness, and we had the program at Jupiter Medical Center in the late 90s and early 2000s. I sent a handful of people for it's an 8-week program, as you know, MBSR. Mm-hmm. And these were chronic insomnias we had worked with, they weren't satisfied with their sleep. And all the patients I sent came back saying they were better. But a couple of them came back, said they were better, but their sleep had not improved. And they just said, thank you, doctor, for sending me. It's great. It's the greatest thing. For instance, one guy said, I'm not sleeping any better, but I am so much more present with my 5-year-old. And that to me is so much more worth it that I'm not even worrying about my sleep, which, by the way, got him better sleep. But instead of focusing on what the sleep was doing with that open-mindedness, they came back and said, my life is better in these ways, and that's okay. Still, many people do want direct guidance on what to do. So for me, in a nutshell, the simplest thing to do is what we call a body scan.
Yeah.
There's many reasons to do the body scan over the breathing. In fact, a report just came out showing why the body scan can be better, and it compared against a breathing exercise, not relaxation, but simple following the breath versus doing a body scan. And the body scan came out, the people who had the body scan slept better, likely because of the ability to stay calm and have a balanced mind when things are, when the rumination starts, I'm not sleeping, oh my God, this is that, when the agitation and the physical arousal comes from that. With the body scan, it tended to have a little bit better of effect than the breathing. So, for me, what I tell people is just to start with a body scan at the beginning of the night or when you wake up in the middle of the night and just go from there, which is also the suggestion from my point of view to stay in contact with someone that knows, a knowledgeable teacher, group, or friend, rather than just picking up a recording or an app and just doing that on your own. Especially if it's a chronic sleep problem, it's just going to be very difficult to get. You may get lost, you may get confused, you may do the wrong thing. Let's put it that way.
Those are two really great tips. So for listeners that are wondering about, okay, so what can I do right now? So one of the things is to before you even do these two things, join a group, identify whether you want to go on to, Gus's site and sign up for his class. If there's someone in your local area, you can do that too. There's a lot of online stuff. I'll post Gus's information at the end of the podcast information and summary about today's session. So if you want to reconnect with him and follow him on Twitter and some of his other social media, he has information about classes there as well. But to first get into a group, have some foundational knowledge about what is mindfulness, join up for a class. Typically, these MBSR courses are 8 weeks. Again, I'm going to post all of Gus's information here so you don't have to worry about, oh gosh, where do I start, right? We always give you that kind of stuff, guys, yeah, right?
And Deb, if I can say, so thank you for that. I appreciate that. But I also do free drop-in sessions once a week. People can just join that. And people come in there with a variety of different brand new practitioners. People have been practicing for a long time and with a whole host of different problems. And I welcome the questions in those sessions. So those are also available. So.
And we'll continue to promote that stuff too. So folks, again, all that information will be at the bottom of the summary. And then on our Twitter page, And then the LinkedIn will go ahead and post those, the information too about the drop-in sessions. And then folks can then have some, a group where you belong to get the guidance and to say walk with somebody, but to get that kind of support that you need, instead of just, you know, doing an ad hoc something, right? So that way also we're able to, if we have questions, to ask people who are familiar with, you know, these series of questions, as well as having the wisdom to direct. And then I also think that helps reduce the anxiety component for a lot of our listeners, because that's one of the things that will come up is I want to do this. And then that rumination starts of that mind going over, but I have this question and this question, and this question, or I heard about this experience and that experience. So those are two really good tips right now. Belong to a group, do the body scan. On a sidebar note, whenever I've done the body scan, especially in corporate settings, I'll let people know that if you fall asleep, it's okay. That's the greatest compliment ever. And there have been people who you start off and you can see them just ready to drift in. And then the next thing you know, the room is so quiet. The largest group I did that with was a group of 200 people. And it was absolutely amazing. So many people were, I'm so sorry that I fall asleep. And I always say in the beginning, if you fall asleep, that is the greatest compliment, really. And it's not about me. It's about them.
So that was to my point, because if you, of course, obviously in an insomniac, when they fall asleep, they're saying, oh, it's successful. But if you don't fall asleep and the mind's still ruminating, that doesn't mean you failed with the body scan. That's the, exactly the point. So thanks for bringing that up. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. There's so many, I want to say wisdom nuggets, and then the, that experience. When you see somebody else as well as yourself, there are times, guests, where I'll do body scan laying in bed and I can't even remember where I get to, and I'm, that's it. And the next thing I know, my alarm's going off, which is great. So folks have gotten a couple tips here. If you were to say on your journey, things that I wish, not that I wish I knew today, you know, I wish I knew yesterday what I, with the wisdom that I have right now, but what are like maybe three aha, a moment, you know, awareness moments that you would say to yourself, these are three golden nuggets I'd like to share with listeners today about mindfulness and sleep. What would some of those things be?
Yeah. So one would be, the first aha was that I don't have to solve the primary issue. Again, this, it converted me from saying you've got to get your insomnia treated to no, they need to decide for themselves what this, what comes out of this. So I got a better relationship with my kid is a better outcome for mindfulness. So stepping back from insisting, this is what I mean. Had I not taken mindfulness, I would have said, no, 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 that's wrong. You're doing something wrong. You can't be happy without good sleep. So allowing the other person to be more, it's an empowerment and control issue, whatever they decide. Because again, as a doctor, it was you do this or you don't do this, a little authority figure. So that one. And for me also, I guess I got something like the nature, I found that the nature of the mind is to heal. That if we just allow it to do so, it will heal on its own. But before, I think above that, beyond that, is going to be that it wants to be safe. So it does a lot of protective mechanisms. And I think I'm sure in PTSD, that's one of the big issues that comes up. So it's always trying to protect and, like you said, project, deny, suppress, and all of that gets in the way of the healing process. Mindfulness helps untangle that, but that requires a skillful teacher, therapist, group, et cetera, just like you said. And then also, over time, done with the practices, there's no end. So in so many of the things I was taught anyway, you go to first grade, you get to second grade, you get to high school, you get to college, you go to medical school to get training to be a doctor, and then you retire and blah, blah, blah. There was sort of a pattern that there was an end and each thing ended and then you go on to the next thing. Here with mindfulness, it's a nonlinear learning. So again, you may do a body scan every night and not sleep well, and then your sixth body scan, suddenly you're sleeping great. And so staying open-minded, keeping an attitude that's open to results, as we say, just show up, pay attention, and stay open to what may happen, which again was a lot different than practicing medicine, where there's no, you're going to do this, constrict it down, and these are the results we're looking for, more or less. So that open-mindedness that comes with mindfulness was really huge. So
I find the same thing that happens in organizations where people, leaders will call and say, you know, we want something for our employees. And typically it's within a high risk group. Construction is also considered a high risk group because of the impact of distractions, whether it's a non-life-threatening injury or a life-threatening injury. And executives will want to know what the, you know, what the results are. They want the data, they want the numbers, they want the statistics. What's interesting though, is I've learned when I ask a question of, when have you ever made a business decision, regardless of the, what the data says, but it goes against your gut, what do you do? And that helps me connect what mindfulness really is about with executives. Because every time I ask that question, Gus, an executive will say, if regardless what the data is, if my gut's telling me, don't do it, I don't do it. Because whenever I do, it's been the worst decision ever. And then I say to them, I explain, exactly that experience is what mindfulness can help us with. And do it real time too, where it becomes, like you said, something that we do always. It's not this, I'm going to go through an 8-week MBSR class, get myself a certificate. Even with getting a certificate, it means we've accomplished something, but it's not an end accomplishment. Right. It's not like it's a terminal degree where, you know, you go and you get a JD or an MD or a PhD or an EDD. And I think, how do we help listeners with redirecting mindset then? Can we talk a little bit about that? Because I know we're coming up here to close to our end time here, but what can we do to information and maybe things that people can think about to be have this openness, to be open-minded?
Yeah, I think it's going to be learned best by direct experience of staying open. Like I said, you know, the guy who said, I'm here for better sleep, but then found totally surprised, an aha moment. And those aha moments, like you probably were alluding to, are really more very powerful. And so keeping the open mind. And so one thing I'd suggest these days, since we're supposedly washing our hands and putting sanitizer, make that a mindfulness practice and just do these little things throughout the day and just see how the rest of your day goes. Because it's not only a pause, it's that bringing attention to your own body and being still, letting your mind do what it needs to do to settle out and such, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why we sleep, to let our brain sort of tease apart what's necessary to remember and not necessary to remember. So all of these little things, you burn up less energy using the emotional, you know, ruminating and being all upset, the brain's using energy, so you won't feel so burnt out. Just by doing these simple activities. And so if you're, it's sort of like keep a skeptical mind, says, oh, I don't know if that's true. Let me just try that for a week. Every time you wash your hands, every time you walk from here to there, just keep your attention on your body. And then just see after a week, see for yourself. You don't have to believe me or the research or the experts or whoever started this practice thousands of years ago. Just do it for yourself and find out. And then make it your own.
I love that. Do it for yourself. And find out, I'm writing this down. I want to put this on the summary. Do it for yourself and find out and make it your own. That is a fantastic way to conclude our podcast today. Gus, I can't thank you enough for being here today. You guys, I'm going to post everything on PTSD and Beyond now is on iHeartRadio. We're on Spotify. We have iTunes podcasts. We've got Google Play. There's so many Podbean, so many places where you can find the PTSD and Beyond podcast. Our guest today, again, is Dr. Gus Castellanos, an amazing MBSR certified practitioner, retired neurologist, and sleep specialist. Gus, again, it was a pleasure to have you on today's podcast. Is there anything else that you'd like to say real quickly before we conclude?
No, thank you. Thank you. And I do welcome feedback freely offered. Anybody wants to contact me about any questions, as long as you know it's not medical advice, I'm happy to discuss anything about mindfulness. But thank you and congratulations for being on all those sites. That's great.
Thank you so much. I know it's our audience continues to grow. Whenever I see the maps, I just think, wow, okay, look at that. That's amazing. So there's a lot of people that are getting assistance from the podcast. Thank you. All right, you guys, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. And as always, we'll see each other every Friday. Make sure you download and share, comment. And again, I'll have Gus's information in the summary and feel comfortable to give him a shout out and a reach out. And we'll see everybody next week on PTSD and Beyond.